Before we get into today's episode, I want to let you know about a free ebook for you to download today that you won't want to miss. It's called In Conversation with Jordan Peterson, Atheism, Christianity, and the Psychology of Belief. This special ebook was created from an unbelievable podcast with famed Canadian psychologist Jordan Peterson. And in it, you'll discover how to bring order to a chaotic world using the wisdom of the Bible. So download your free copy of In Conversation with Jordan Peterson by visiting premierinsight.org/resources. That's premierinsight.org/resources. This is a limited time offer, so make sure to do it today. That's premierinsight.org/resources. And now it's time for today's podcast.
Hello and welcome along to Unbelievable. Yes, it's already Saturday afternoon. It's already that time of the week when we bring Christians and non-Christians together for discussion and debate. I'm Justin Briley, the host of the show that's been going now nearly 10 years, believe it or not. It will be coming up in the autumn. But if you're a new listener today, perhaps tuning in for the first time on a Saturday to Premier Christian Radio, or perhaps have just discovered the podcast because of you've been told by someone, haven't you heard about this great debate show that occurs every week over in the UK? Well, welcome along. It's great to have you with me. And what we're going to be looking forward to do today is the second round of a highly anticipated couple of debates between Bart Ehrman and Tim McGrew. I'll be introducing them again in a moment's time. But later on today, if you're listening here on Premier Christian Radio to Faith Explored, then you can hear the profile between 4 and 5. Erica Freemantle is an award-winning makeup artist to the stars, and she'll be telling her story of life and faith between 4 and 5 this Saturday afternoon. Don't forget, you can contact the show as well, unbelievable@premier.org.uk, to send in your thoughts about anything you hear on today's programme. And you can send the show on to others, tell them about it. Many people have discovered Unbelievable through a friend, through a tweet, through reading about it on a blog. And if you want to access all the past archive, subscribe to the podcast, look at the features, the blog, the videos from the various conferences we've held, then why not simply go to the portal for all of that at premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable, and you'll be able to see what I'm talking about there. We've got some of your feedback coming up later on in today's show, but right now let's get into today's discussion.
You're unbelievable.
Well, I'm looking forward to this round two today, as I'm joined again from last week with Bart Ehrman and Tim McGrew. Bart Ehrman, a New Testament scholar out at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. And as I mentioned last week, well known for his popular books questioning the reliability of the New Testament accounts, books like Misquoting Jesus and Jesus Interrupted. He's been on this show a number of times in discussion with various other scholars for some of those works. But last week he had a really interesting interaction with Tim McGrew, who's a scholar of philosophy out at Western Michigan University, but who's turned his hand to scholarly works, to looking into the scholarship, at least, of the reliability of the New Testament. And we had quite the debate about that last week. This week, we're going to be looking more at the question of whether undesigned coincidences give the Gospels the ring of truth. Now, Tim will explain that in the course of the programme. But effectively, it's the idea that there are various examples of undesigned coincidences within and between the Gospels which corroborate the stories and give a high probability of them having a factual basis, and perhaps even evidence for the miraculous claims that are made there as well. And I'd love us to get to that in the course of today's programme as well, gentlemen, because I think that opens up a whole nother area when it comes to looking historically at the Gospels as to whether we can accept the miraculous. So welcome back, Bart. Just as we get underway in today's programme, having had the introduction to you last week, have you ever come across this particular argument before? I think it's fairly new to you as far as you can see.
I'm not familiar with how Tim works it out. Of course, I mean, the relationships of the Gospels to one another has been a area of study for a very long time, and scholars have ways of working out why there are agreements between Gospels and disagreements among Gospels. And so I'll be interested in hearing his theory.
Okay, great stuff. Just a reminder, if you want to find out any more about Bart, if your interest has been piqued, ehrmanblog.org, Ehrman, E-H-R-M-A-N blog.org, and you can go there to yeah, see the blog and join the community that likes to discuss things there. Tim McGrew joins me again. And Tim, if people want to find out a bit more about you, I mean, I know that your articles pop up all over the place online. What would be a good place to send people or terms to search for if they're just using Google?
Sure. Well, if they're interested in my academic work, they can visit my webpage at wmish.edu. I have a homepage there with a few things up, mostly not of apologetic interest, more things in epistemology, history and philosophy of science, although I have a little bit of philosophy of religion work there as well. I do some work for apologetics.com. They can go there and see links to some of my works and give quite a number of lectures on things like the Gospels, the internal and the external evidences, charges of contradiction, charges of historical error, and videos for all of that can be found on YouTube. Just Google my name with any of those terms and that'll come up.
And don't mistake you for the country and western singer Tim McGraw, which is...
Every time I speak down south, somebody thinks he's the first person to notice that, yes.
I only know that because I Googled Tim McGraw and it tried to auto-correct me to Tim McGraw, gospel, country and western singer. But anyway, we have, you know, we have the philosopher Tim McGraw, not the country and western singer Tim McGraw with me today. And Tim, maybe right at the outset, you need to give us a sense of what this interesting argument is that I've referred to already. The undesigned coincidences of the gospel and why they lend the gospels the ring of truth. Why don't you take a couple of minutes just to explain what this whole concept is?
Sure. In many of his books, Bart speaks of the difference between reading the gospels vertically and reading them horizontally, between taking a gospel and sort of reading it all through front to back, and then maybe picking up another one and reading it through front to back. And on the other hand, cross-comparing them, looking at passages where similar subjects come up in different Gospels, noting small variations between them, trying to speculate as to what those differences might mean. I'm a big believer in both kinds of reading. Mm-hmm. And I don't think Bart would disagree with me there, but I'd like to encourage him to do even more horizontal reading than he does already. And so, in a way, this is an exercise in horizontal reading. But it's an exercise which, instead of taking the same story told in different Gospels, tends to look for different contexts or the same story with different sets of details and to ask, do these kinds of things interlock? Does one of the Gospels explain another? And the funny thing is that once you look into this, there are many cases of this crisscrossing the Gospels in all directions. The synoptics explain John. John explains the synoptics. The synoptics explain one another. So the interlockings there are pretty extensive, and they're omnidirectional. They don't just have one direction that they all go, like Mark explaining everybody else or everybody else explaining Mark. I think that's an interesting and important point from the standpoint of people who are worried about the synoptic problem, because what it shows is that whatever else you may think about that, the authors of the Gospels have independent sources of information, not just special L or special M, the Lucan and Matthean sources apart from Q, if Q even exists. But even in some of the places where they're tracking with Mark, they have details that can be corroborated that are not found in Mark.
And
let me give you one example of this.
Yeah, give us an example. That'll help.
It's easier to see this in this way than it is just by an abstract discussion.
Sure.
So, in Matthew 14, we've got the story of the death of John the Baptist. Mm-hmm. And the setup for the scene has Herod Antipas reflecting on what he's hearing about Jesus, and he turns to his servants and says, "What's going on here? I had John the Baptist killed. He's back from the dead. What is this?" And the really important thing from the standpoint of this argument is those three words, "to his servants."
Okay.
Matthew is a tax collector turned itinerant preacher. Mm-hmm. How does he know what Herod Antipas is saying, presumably in the privacy of his own palace, to his own servants? Now, we have lots of questions like this in ordinary historical work, and we can't demand that we find answers for them, but it's curious. It makes us wonder. Mm-hmm. If you go over to Luke chapter 8, verse 3, not the story of the death of John the Baptist, rather a list of women who minister to Jesus and his disciples, you find that it mentions Joanna. And it describes her a little bit. It says she's the wife of Huzzah, Herod's household manager, his steward. And
Okay. Suddenly
it's not a mystery how Matthew could have known what Herod was saying to his servants. Jesus' followers had family in the highest ranks of Herod's servants. So there's just one example of an interconnection between two of the synoptics and one that does not involve Mark.
Okay, and an interconnection which you would say was in no way designed. It simply just happens that
think anybody would accuse Luke of putting in that parenthetical remark in order to cover for the puzzling question about Matthew. And I don't think anybody would argue the reverse, that Matthew put in that little phrase to his servants in order to dovetail with Luke's description of Joanna. Okay. I think that would really be wild if anybody wanted to try to maintain that.
But the overall result of this, as far as you're concerned, Tim, is that we have, if you like, an inductive argument that suggests that there is an independent source that kind of that then you're linking, and it all adds to the credibility of the story because of this corroboration in that sense. Now,
right, and in this case, it's something where Matthew has some information that's not found in Mark, and I think that's an interesting point to note. It's not just dependency on Mark.
Okay, we'll come back to the Mark issue, because I know you've had your critics who say all of these undesigned coincidences can simply be people building on what Mark first kind of put down. But we'll come back to that. And we'll come back to some more examples as well. But you kind of didn't look very convinced there, Bart, when Tim was explaining that. You can't see each other because you're on a line here, Tim, but you looked incredulous, I would say, at Tim's suggestion that these two match up to each other in this way.
Right. Well, no, if what you want to do is harmonize the Gospels so that they're all telling historically accurate material, this is the way you would go about doing it. So in Matthew 14, when Herod says something to his servants, and you want to know how would Matthew know that he was talking to his servants, or what he actually said to his servants. Of course, that's a problem that we have with a lot of the Gospels. Just to pick a second example of the same thing, in the Gospel of John, unlike Matthew, Mark, and Luke, in the Gospel of John, when Jesus is put on trial before Pontius Pilate, nobody else is in the room. It's Jesus and Pilate, because the Jewish authorities won't go into the praetorium because they don't want to be defiled, so they stay outside. Pilate is inside, and Pilate goes back and forth between the accused and the accusers. And so he'll talk to Jesus, then he'll go out and talk to the Jews, then he'll go inside and talk to Jesus, then out to the Jews. So he has these extensive conversations with Jesus, but there's nobody in the room except for him and Jesus. And so people have asked, well, how does John know what Pilate said? I mean, they didn't get from Jesus because he was taken off to be crucified, and Pilate probably wasn't available for questioning later by Christian interviewers. And so how would they know exactly? And so I've always thought that that's probably the wrong kind of question to ask, because people who ask that question about John just haven't read enough books. People who write books all the time say things that they'd have no way of knowing. Charles Dickens reports all sorts of conversations that never happened. The fact that he reports them doesn't mean that he had special access to some kind of historical information about what David Copperfield really said. It's just he's writing a story, and people write stories. And we know from ancient historians themselves, including Thucydides, that when historians wrote accounts of what people said, they usually made it up. And so I don't think we need to ask the question, how does Matthew know what Herod said to his servants? This is simply the way that you write accounts about what happened in the past.
Okay. So, okay, Tim, we don't need to do all this trying to marry up one bit of the gospel against another. People just invented conversations because it helped the story along back in the day. What's your response to that? And if you want to then draw out some more of these examples, feel free.
Sometimes they do, and sometimes they don't. And some historians castigate others for inventing conversations that didn't take place. So this is not such a uniform thing as all that. Sure, there are lots of instances of that. Josephus is sometimes guilty of that. Thucydides is sometimes guilty of that. But in other cases, that's not the case, and people are very concerned to get the gist of what was said. Word for word, Not likely. The gist of what was said? Sure. Mm. Now, I'm really interested in a couple of things about this John 18 passage, so I'm glad that Bart brought it up. First of all, Bart says that nobody else was in the room. I'm sorry, John 18 doesn't say that. It says that the Jewish leaders didn't enter Pilate's house or headquarters. It does not say nobody else was in the room but Jesus and Pilate. There were undoubtedly guards there. It is possible that John himself slipped in. He seems to have been known to the high priest and to have had a certain amount of freedom in his movement. So I think that's just reading something into the story that isn't there. Yeah, the Jewish leaders are outside. It does not follow, as Bart said, that nobody else was there. But there's more than that. Let's look at that conversation, because I think it's a really interesting one. What's the first thing that Pilate asks him? He enters the headquarters, and in John 18:33, he calls Jesus and he says, "Are you the king of the Jews?" Now, the curious thing about that is that that's not an accusation that John records. That's not one of the things that he has the Jewish leaders say. So why would that be on Pilate's mind? Well, turn back to Luke 23, and you'll find a fuller account of the charges against Jesus. And one of those charges, and a grave one, one that Pilate would have to take seriously, is that he makes himself to be Christ, a king. Caesar's the only one who gets to make a king. So when you look at Luke 23, you see a bit of the context that John has left out. It's not like John is saying something false, but there's this inexplicable first question coming from Pilate, and it's answered there. This is
so this is another example of an undesigned coincidence, then, that
yeah,
Luke,
and then
Luke fills in some info. Yeah,
right, we get this one going in both directions, because in Luke 23, Pilate asks Jesus, "Are you a king?" And Jesus has this very terse response, "You say so, sou leges." And that's all Luke tells us. And then Pilate turns around, goes out, and says, "I find no fault in this man." What is wrong with this picture? The Jews make a grave accusation that Pilate, as Caesar's representative, must take seriously. He asks Jesus about this very question. Jesus either admits it or, at the very least, insouciantly refuses to respond in the negative, and Pilate promptly turns around and acquits him. Well, if you go over to John 18 and look at the fuller conversation that's reported there, you discover that when he says, "Are you a king?" Jesus, in the course of that conversation, says, "My kingdom is not of this world. If my kingdom were of this world, my servants would have been fighting." Oh, not that kind of king, a philosopher king of some kind. And now we can understand why Pilate would say, "This is not a threat to Caesar. This is not something that I need to take in that way." So each of the passages contains details left out by the other. This is not what happens when you get people sitting down to write stories. Nobody picks up David Copperfield looking for answers to those unresolved questions you had about Moby Dick. Those two stories are not anchored in the same independent reality. These are.
That's a really interesting way of putting it. Okay, plenty of food for thought there, Bart.
Yeah. No, you're right. People don't do that with David Copperfield because people have no reason to want to make David Copperfield and Moby Dick align with each other. If people did have reasons to want to do that, they would find all sorts of things that were very similar that they'd be amazed at. I think there's an easier explanation than undesigned coincidences for the trial before Pilate. It's a fairly standard explanation, which is that Jesus of Nazareth was condemned to death by the governor of Judea, Pontius Pilate, because he was calling himself the king of the Jews. This was a historical datum. This was what was widely known. This was known independently to people. It was known to whoever wrote John. It was known to whoever wrote Luke. It was known to whoever wrote Mark. And they all told stories about it. Their stories, in many ways, can't be reconciled with each other, but they have the same basic view, namely that this is why Jesus was executed. And so it's not strange at all that Jesus gets asked, "Are you the king of the Jews?" in both John and in Luke and in Mark and in Matthew. It's because that was the issue. The reason that in the Gospel of John and in the Gospel of Luke that Pilate at first doesn't seem to do anything about it once Jesus admits he's the king of the Jews has a different reason. It's because with the passing of time, Christians were increasingly convinced that, or at least they increasingly wanted to say, that the reason Jesus was crucified was not because of the actions of the Roman governor. The reason Jesus was crucified was because of the hatred of the Jewish leaders, and eventually, of course, the Jewish people themselves. If you look through our traditions, if you arrange our traditions chronologically, so suppose you start with the Gospel of Mark, and then you move to Matthew, then to Luke, then to John, and then to the Gospel of Peter in the second century, and then to what Justin Martyr says, and then and so on. You arrange things chronologically. What the most striking feature of the traditions about Jesus being condemned to death is that Pilate becomes increasingly innocent with the passing of time, and the Jewish people become increasingly guilty. That's because as Christians were telling and retelling their stories, they were in heightened situations of antagonism with Jews. And Christians began portraying Jews as the ones responsible for Jesus' death. And so that's why in the later sources, Pilate has to have his arm twisted, because that shows that, in fact, it's the Jews who are at fault.
Okay. Any responses to that, Tim? It's taking us off in an altogether different direction at this point.
Yeah, I think this is a kind of literary criticism that gives certain branches of New Testament scholarship a bad name. That is an awful, a wholesale return of conjecture on a trifling investment of fact. It is not, it does not really answer the question, why is it that in Luke 23, Jesus is acquitted by Pilate without any recognizable reason? It doesn't answer the question, why is it that Pilate, who apparently, as we read John 18, is just now figuring out who this Jesus guy is, what have you done, he asks him, doesn't answer the question why he says, as the first thing that we have recorded in John, are you the king of the Jews? It's only by putting these two passages together that we can see it in stereoscopic vision. Bart wants to say, oh, it's all just sort of stories being told in order to absolve the Romans and put the blame on the Jewish leaders. No doubt they did think that the Jewish leaders were primarily responsible, but I don't see that as answering the data that we're looking at here. That's really just a conjecture about the psychology of early Christianity that seems to me to be not terribly well-founded.
Okay.
Yeah, no, I'll respond to that. I wasn't aware that New Testament literary critics had a bad name, and so I'd be interested in knowing who says that. But let me just explain a little bit, because maybe I wasn't very clear. In the Gospel of Mark, when Jesus is put on trial, Pilate asks him, are you the king of the Jews? Jesus says, su leges, you say so. And Pilate condemns Jesus because the people are insisting on it. But it's basically Pilate and the Jewish leaders pretty much agreeing that this needs to be done. When you get to the Gospel of Matthew, Pilate resists so much, in fact, that he calls for water and he washes his hands before the crowds and he says, I am innocent of this man's blood. And the Jews cry out, his blood be upon us and our children. In other words, the Jewish crowds are taking responsibility for Jesus' death, unlike Mark. When you go later to the Gospel of Luke, Pilate not only declares that that Jesus is innocent, Pilate declares Jesus innocent on three separate occasions, and Herod declares Jesus innocent on one occasion. The innocence of Pilate is being heightened here. When you get to the Gospel of John, it's even more striking. This is something you wouldn't get in the reading it in most English translations. The three times, once more, Pilate declares Jesus innocent. And finally, when the Jewish priests insist that Pilate crucify him, the Greek text says, so Pilate handed him over to them to be crucified. The antecedent there are the Jewish priests. They're the ones who crucify Jesus in the Gospel of John. When you get later, you go to the Gospel of Peter, the Jews are even more responsible for the death of Jesus. By the middle of the second century, Jews are being called Christ killers. By the end of the second century, Jews are being accused of deicide, of actually killing God. There's no question at all that Jews are shown as increasingly responsible for the death of Jesus, and that can explain the changes in the Gospels.
Okay. Well, that was the fuller explanation in that sense, Tim. But for you, what I'm hearing is well, that's not really the issue at stake here. It's an issue of
how you... two things. First of all, we wandered off into the second century there, and I'd like to keep our discussion to the Gospels that we have reason to believe were written, circulated, quoted, and treated as authoritative in the first, which is not something that I would be willing to grant about the Gospel of Peter, and I'm not sure that Bart would either. I think this attempt to find trajectories in the resurrection and crucifixion narratives is largely a function of cherry-picking. There are statements in all of the Synoptic Gospels where Jesus says to the Sanhedrin, "You shall see the Son of Man sitting in the right hand of power." Jesus predicts his death multiple times in the Gospel of Mark. Statements like these are not found in John. What's happening? Bart has wanted to make various trajectories. One of them that he discusses at some length is from a human, vulnerable, baffled Jesus to one who is triumphant. But actually, a lot of these things can be argued the opposite direction if you pick and choose your data. So I think that's just not persuasive. Bart asks, who are these people who say these things about New Testament scholars? Let me give you a couple of quotations here from E.M. Blakelock, a New Zealand classicist. Quote, "A classical scholar finds it difficult to be patient with some of the exotic theories of literary criticism, which have bedeviled New Testament studies. Classical historians have been a little ironical in recent decades over the calculated skepticism of New Testament scholars who refuse to see what the classicists so naturally see, a record of life in the first century, if no more than that, which must at least be accorded its unique value as historical material. When critical theory seeks to persuade that liturgical and spiritual needs and aspirations taking shape from nowhere and within the lifetime of those who had known the first half of the first century themselves created a supporting literature, the narratives and sayings which form the Gospels, fantasy is propounded, which would provoke ridicule in any less confined and introverted sphere of literary criticism." Let me give you another one. Blakelock is not alone. Here's John Rist, another classicist, in an autobiographical statement. "Thus, the full range of Christian claims must go back to the very earliest followers of Jesus, and in all probability, to Jesus himself. I could no longer delude myself that real scholarship told us that we have no evidence that Jesus himself, as well as the earliest generation of his followers, made claims for his divinity. The attempt of biblical critics to show that such claims grew up or were fabricated within the church seemed to be a tissue of bad argument, unhistorical treatment of the sources, and wishful thinking, the wish being to make Christianity acceptable to the conventional liberal orthodoxy."
Okay, so, obviously...
"The resulting scholarship was defective to a degree that would not be acceptable in other philological disciplines."
Okay,
and I have more like this.
Yeah, obviously there are some classicists out there who say that certain biblical scholarship is giving it a bad name. I mean, okay, we're going to have to go to a break, and we'll come back, because I'm sure Bart wants to respond there. I do want us to get as well to the other issue. Perhaps we will have time for one more of these undesigned coincidences to talk through. But whether this, as you claim, I think also, Tim, actually gives us evidence for the miraculous claims in the New Testament, because I think that's another area we should try and break open before our time comes to a close. So come back in a moment's time as we conclude today's discussion, or at least have the second part of today's discussion, on whether the undesigned coincidences between the Gospels give them the ring of truth. My guests today on Unbelievable, Tim McGrew and Bart Ehrman.
Premier Christianity, for cutting-edge commentary and encouraging stories.
Tackling the big issues to help you live out your faith.
This month, the Vicar of Holy Trinity Brompton, Nicky Gumbel, gives an exclusive interview on the church's ambitious planting strategy as HDB seeks to breathe new life into dying congregations around the UK. We ask, what can Christians do to defy ISIS? And meet a Mormon. Michael Flournoy explains his beliefs, while Lynn Wilder tells her story of leaving the Mormon Church for Christianity.
For your free copy of Premier Christianity, visit premierchristianity.com/freesample.
You're listening to Unbelievable on Premier Christian Radio.
Well, today on Unbelievable, we've been engaging in what you could call a summer of scripture. It's following on from last week's discussion, Bart Ehrman and Tim McGrew are looking into some of the claims for and against the reliability of the Gospels. And today we're asking, do undesigned coincidences, and Tim McGrew, one of my guests today, spelled that out, do they give the Gospels the ring of truth? We've heard a couple of really interesting examples today of where it appears that there's a corroboration between different accounts, John and Matthew, or Luke and Matthew, and so on. Well, we're going to be hearing a bit more about that from Tim McGrew in the course of today's programme. Bart Ehrman, New Testament scholar at the University of North Carolina, well known for taking a more sceptical view and making it available to the public through books like Misquoting Jesus and Jesus Interrupted, is in discussion with Tim McGrew today. We were hearing Tim giving a couple of examples where he thinks that this trajectory idea of Christians gradually kind of making either Jesus more divine or making the Jews look worse and so on, it's giving biblical scholarship a bad name, he says. And he gave a couple of examples of why he of classicists who say, we've got to go back to the earlier sources, and there's not the evidence there that many people in.
Right. I mean, it's possible to quote various people who are opposed to anything. That doesn't mean that so there's generally a bad name associated with it. There are mythicists who will say that historians have a bad name. Well, you have to consider the source. I mean, if a mythicist says that the study of the historical Jesus has given history a bad name, I mean, well, okay, that's fine. They can think that. And the people that Tim is quoting, yes, they're right. They have the right to their opinion. The question isn't whether somebody has that opinion or not. The question is whether it's justified. I laid out a case for how it is that the Gospels increasingly portray Jews guilty and Pilate innocent in the death of Jesus. I wasn't restricting myself to second century sources. I started with our earliest sources, Mark, Matthew, Luke, and John, and I showed that there is, in fact, this trajectory. There's nothing particularly cherry-picking about that. That's simply showing the trajectory that anybody can see when you line them up on chronological basis. And it's that trajectory that can explain precisely the data that Tim is talking about when he wants to take one detail from one gospel and another detail from another gospel and say, see, here's an undesigned coincidence.
Tim?
Yeah, I don't think that explains the data, and I would just challenge Bart, if you think your trajectory hypothesis explains why Pilate acquits Jesus with nothing more than what is reported in Luke 23, let's have it.
Okay, I'll give it to you. I'll give it to you. It's in order to show that Jesus, by Roman standards, was completely innocent. And the only reason Pilate condemned Jesus was because the Jewish authorities insisted he did.
That doesn't explain it.
It does explain
Pilate's
it.
Pilate's actions from a Roman perspective are unaccountable if Luke had given us what, if we took what Luke gives us as a complete description
yes,
of what
Yes, because Luke
there.
Wants
that
to show.
That doesn't explain it at all.
It does. It's because Luke
Pilate's
is trying to show.
Pilate's abrogating his responsibility if he's saying, you're a king? Oh, great, fine, no problem. That is unaccountable. I don't think you are.
Where does Pilate say that? Where does Pilate say that?
Well, isn't the point that Tim's making is that if Jesus admitted to the charge of being king of the Jews, Pilate,
right,
by Roman standards, should have had him crucified by Romans at that point.
What does Jesus reply when Luke says that, when Pilate asks him that in Luke?
Tu leges, you've said.
Uh-huh. And what does that mean?
Well, it means one of two things. Either it means you say it yourself, or it means, yep, you said so. And either of those answers is utterly insufficient.
Does he say, yes, I am a king?
Pilate immediately in the narrative goes out and says, I find no fault with this man.
Why doesn't Jesus say, yes, I am?
Do you think he's not saying that by saying, su leges?
I absolutely don't think he's saying that.
Right interpretations do differ on that, right?
Well, the words for yes, I am are a me.
The yeah, there's a way of doing it that way, and then there's this colloquial expression.
Oh, really?
Right?
Where does Suleges show up otherwise?
Is it a denial of the charge? Is it a negative answer to the question, are you the king of the Jews?
Where is Suleges used to say yes, I am elsewhere?
I'm not saying that it has to be. I've said it could bear a couple of meanings, but none of them would explain what Pilate does.
My point is, Pilate has not gone against any Roman judicial practices Pilate has said that Jesus is innocent, and he's saying that in the narrative precisely because it's trying to show who finds him guilty. It's the Jewish authorities. This is trying to show that the Romans are not at fault for the killing of Jesus. It's the Jews who are guilty. That's all part of what's going on in Luke's own historical context when Christians are blaming Jews for the death of Jesus.
The Jewish leaders, not the Jewish populace.
But it's your contention that the best way of explaining why Pilate doesn't immediately go and have Jesus crucified is that John fills in the gap as to why he didn't do that. There's extra information.
Luke is giving us a compressed narration of what's going on.
And
in that compression, he leaves out something that leaves the narrative inexplicable as it stands. Bart doesn't see a problem with it, but I think that's because he's in the grip of a literary theory of development here that does not actually do the job he thinks that it does.
My view is that you should not use one author in order to explain what another author is trying to say. So that, for example, if you're trying to understand what Livy is trying to say at a particular place in his history of Rome, you don't go to Diocasus to find out what Livy is trying to say.
Let's take another example, because I think another example may help to flesh this general area out. This is an interesting one that I think you've spoken of. I don't know whether you use it much yourself, Tim, or not, but it's the feeding of the 5,000 in John chapter 6, which apparently intersects with Luke's account of that in chapter 9. And again, it's one of these little detective-type details that you point out as bringing this intersection of those two accounts of the stories and giving them this historical credibility. So do you want to explain that? And Bart will come back.
Sure, happy to do that. But first, I'd like to just say something brief about Bart's statement that you don't look to one author to explain what another author means. I don't see that that's any kind of general rule of historical inquiry. Sure, we don't want to read back onto one author the concerns of another that he might not have had. But there are plenty of times when we look at accounts in multiple sources, when we are fortunate enough to have multiple sources, and we ask ourselves if something emerges in stereo from this. So to take an example, let's look at John 6, right, the feeding of 5,000. When we have the setup for the story, Jesus turns to one of his disciples and says, "Where are we to buy bread so that these people may eat?" Mm-hmm. Which disciple does he pick?
Well, I only know this because I looked at
your example earlier,
but I'm not claiming to be an absolute Bible expert. But in this case, it's Philip, isn't it?
It's Philip, right? Mm. Who is as close to being a non-entity as one of the disciples of Jesus can be.
Mm.
I think after the calling of the disciples, Jesus speaks to Philip one other time in all of the Gospels that we have recorded. Now, of course, there's a lot that happens that's not recorded in them, right? John himself explicitly says Jesus did many other things, but he's not a big character. So why is it that Jesus turns to Philip and asks him that?
Okay.
Now, you can read all around in John 6, and there is no answer to this question. But if you go over to Luke chapter 9, setting for the same miracle, you find that it takes place in a desert place in the region of Bethsaida. And then if you jump forward to John 12:21, totally different context. Some Greeks come to see Jesus. They say, "We'd like to speak with Jesus." And they speak to Philip. And just parenthetically, John mentions who was from the region of Bethsaida, right? He's from Bethsaida. This is where he comes from.
Okay.
You have to put all three of these pieces together to understand why Jesus might turn to Philip. "Philip, you're from around here. Where's the local supermarket? Think we can buy enough for this many people?" That's only one of numerous interconnections among the stories of the feeding of the 5,000, which is, of course, a miracle story. Now, I am far from saying that the mere existence of the undesigned coincidences here by itself legitimates belief in the miracle story. That is not the point that I am trying to make. The point that I do want to make is that cumulatively, and this is a cumulative argument,
mm-hmm.
putting these pieces together strengthens our realization that these are descriptions drawn by people who are close up to the facts. They're well-informed, they're habitually truthful, and so even their divergent expressions sometimes dovetail in ways that we just don't see in works of fiction, at least not before the invention of the modern realistic novel.
Yes. So there's a sense in which it's either an extraordinary lucky coincidence, or by people who were writing completely different things, or else they were working off, you know, people, real people, and they weren't intending to make a coincidence here, but it just so happens that because they were working off real events and real people, we find out, as it happens, that, Philip came from Bethsaida in John, and that gives an explanation for why in Luke Jesus turns to Philip when they're in the region.
Actually, it's in John that he turns
the other way around.
In Luke, but that's set there, right.
But you get the point. Yeah. What's your response to all of this then?
Okay,
Bob?
I've got two responses. So the first one, I'm not quite sure. So Tim, I haven't read your stuff. So I'm doing this just off the top of my head. So I don't have anything to interact with. But I'm not quite sure why you think Philip is a non-entity. I mean, he's a non-entity in the synoptics. But he's a big entity in the early Christian tradition. We have an Acts of Philip, we have a Gospel of Philip, and in the Gospel of John, he shows up all over the place. He's in the very beginning of the Gospel of John. I'm just doing this off the top of my head, but in the very beginning of the Gospel of John, in chapter 1, he's one of the four people explicitly said to have been called by Jesus. He's at Jesus' at the farewell discourse in chapter 14. He's the one who asks Jesus, "Show us the Father," where Jesus says, "If you've seen me, you've seen the Father." So he's a fairly prominent figure in the Gospel of John. So I wouldn't say that he's marginal at all. And John 1, by the way, says that he's from Bethsaida. So,
right.
Yeah. So, anyway, that's my comment about that. In terms of the undesigned coincidences, I think what we're overlooking is that there is a very wide and broad stream of early Christian tradition as people are telling stories about Jesus and his disciples before anything's written down. These Gospels are being written down years later. Even if you date them early, they're years later. Christians are telling stories about Jesus and his disciples year after year after year, and a lot of people hear stories, and many of the stories are similar stories. And so, of course, when later Gospel writers write down things, they've got some similar sources. I mean, there are scholars, of course, who think that John has access to Matthew, Mark, and Luke. My friend Mark Goodacre at Duke University is now writing a book arguing this, that John has access to these earlier Gospels, which would mean that it's not a coincidence at all, that he simply knows these other Gospels. But whether that's true or not, I personally am doubtful, although I haven't read his book yet. But John has certainly heard many of the same stories told in slightly different forms that were available to the other Gospel writers. And so it doesn't have to be some kind of weird, uncanny coincidence that they mention somebody and give some detail that coincides with what someone else says. These are stories that are in circulation.
Okay. Tim?
Yeah, I don't think that really accounts for it. I think you're missing the force of the word undesigned. I think it would be a remarkable bit of mental gymnastics to say that John has Jesus turn to Philip because he has in mind a comment in Luke that the miracle took place in Bethsaida, even though Luke makes no mention of Philip, and that he would put that in here to corroborate or interconnect with what Luke has said, even though he doesn't bother to mention the setting of the miracle. That just strikes me as an enormous stretch. And again, you know, it's not just this one or that one. It's the overall pattern that I think people need to attend to. And that's why I say the argument is cumulative. Sure. I'm actually inclined to agree with Mark that John had access to the synoptics. But when people are just telling stories before anything is written down, the stories do not generally evolve in a way that they explain one another the way these do. That's more characteristic. Plus, let me give you an example of this from the Battle of Midway. We have memoirs of the Battle of Midway written by Japanese generals and by Americans. So some of the Japanese generals tell their tales. In one of the books by one of them, he says that in the middle of the Battle of Midway, they saw a guy out on the high seas in a little boat. No idea, no connection to anything else, like just mention the detail. And then they wander off, you know, in their own narrative. Just a disconnected fragment. What is somebody doing in the middle of the Pacific in a tiny boat? Turns out if you read the memoirs of some of the pilots who made the raids trying to bomb the Japanese ships, one of them actually made a hit, but his plane was so badly torn up that he had to bail out, and he had a rubber raft. So there he is in the middle of the Atlantic in a rubber raft. Different sources, close to the fact, accidental confirmations like that. This is not deliberate. He didn't make up his story of bailing out in order to interconnect with the Japanese general's account. Things like that give us the ring of truth,
okay.
Especially when there are lots of them.
Yeah, and it's a cumulative case, you say.
Right.
If we're willing to kind of leave that then for the moment and move on to this other issue, before we do that, let me say, because I haven't given much opportunity so far, that if you're listening and you are desperate to have your say on this, I won't necessarily be able to put you directly in touch with Bart or Tim, but you can get in touch with me and have your thoughts read out on a forthcoming programme. Why not email in unbelievable@premier.org.uk, and I'll be happy to see what you make of the arguments that Tim's been putting forward and the criticisms that Bart's been putting forward. And again, you can do that as well by going onto the website premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable. Leave me a comment there underneath the latest edition of the programme. You can subscribe to the podcast as well. Make sure you never miss an episode of Unbelievable and some of these fantastic discussions we're able to put on the air for you. So we're talking about whether undesigned coincidences give the Gospels the ring of truth. My guests today, Tim McGrew and Bart D. Ehrman.
Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
Just out of interest, Bart, what is the D for? I never quite know.
Denton.
Denton. Okay. There you go.
My brother's middle name is Kenton.
I'm one of those unusual people who don't have a middle name, and so I don't have the opportunity to do the fancy initial. Yeah. Tim, just completely side note, do you have a middle name?
I do, Joel.
So do you go by Tim?
Old Testament prophet.
Tim J. McGrew ever, is it?
Timothy Joel.
Okay.
J-O-E-L.
Well, there you go. Funnily enough, I had my fourth child recently, and we went for Joel as the middle name as well in that case. So there you go. Coincidences abound. And we're talking about coincidences on today's programme. We've talked extensively about whether these undesigned coincidences are really as big a deal as Tim makes out. And Bart obviously doesn't feel they are and has different explanations for some of them. I mean, one thing I think that really does kind of divide you two, though, will be the question of whether any amount of historical evidence can give us claim that miracles really happened, though, in the New Testament. So, you know, inevitably, the Gospels are jam-packed with Jesus apparently doing healings, miracles of various kinds. He is known as a wonder worker and so on. Presumably, Bart, for you, does the historical method require that we assume from the outset that no miracles actually took place, that these were the way people saw it, maybe their assumptions or mythical sort of additions later on? What's your take on miracles?
No, my view isn't that historians have to assume miracles didn't happen. There might have been too many negatives in that sentence, but I'm not saying that historians must assume that miracles never happen. Some historians obviously think miracles have happened, and a lot of historians think miracles haven't happened. My view is that if one is engaging in the act of writing history, that one has to bracket the question about whether miracles have happened or not. It's kind of a complicated argument. It's a rather long argument, but the short of it is that historians can't ascribe to any belief in the supernatural if they're going to engage in the historical disciplines. They might believe in it personally, and they might believe that miracles have happened in the past, but history itself can't operate on the basis of supernatural assumptions that some historians have and others don't. And so just by the very nature of things, the writing of history precludes the writing of miracles in our day and age. That's why ancient historians had no trouble describing miracles, because they had a different view of historiography. And modern historians, outside of people writing about the Bible, it seems, every other historian simply doesn't talk about miracle as a causality.
We have talked about this in the context of the resurrection and why fundamentally you can't see that the resurrection is a valid account of the historical facts around the resurrection narratives.
Well, I'm not saying that resurrection didn't happen. I'm saying that as a historian, you can't show it happened on historical grounds. Yeah.
I mean, I don't want us necessarily to do that debate because we've done it before. But Tim, what's your general take on whether, historically speaking, we can talk about miracles having happened?
Why not?
Okay. Short but sweet. I mean, Bart's saying it's because it's out of bounds because we don't do history that way today. In no other area of history do we say miracles happened. Why should it be different when it comes to Christian history?
Is there evidence as good as there is in the Christian history that miracles have occurred?
Yes.
Does Bart want to put the prodigies of Livy on a par with the reports about Jesus' miracles in the New Testament?
No.
Okay, so we have here, at least from my side, an answer to the question of why Roman historians don't need to invoke this. There's simply not the same kind of evidence that there is here.
Okay, so if you want to talk about the kinds of evidence we have in the New Testament, what you have are documents written 40 or 50 years later by people by people who are not eyewitnesses, who are recounting stories.
I disagree there, too.
Okay.
Okay, so let's say they're written by people who have gotten their stories 20 years later from eyewitnesses.
Or who were eyewitnesses themselves. Okay.
Okay, let's give the benefit of the doubt, say, in this instance. I have a feeling you're still going to say that we can't get to miracles from that, but carry on, Bart.
Well, I'm just wondering if you'll agree that if you have other sources of that sort, that you're going to say that those miracles also happened.
Well, tell me about the quality of that evidence.
Okay. Do you know about the Baal Shem Tov?
Yeah.
Okay. The Baal Shem Tov, we have accounts of his life written by people who were directly connected with eyewitnesses, who recount miracle after miracle, casting out demons. The Baal Shem Tov was the founder of the Hasidic movement in Judaism.
I myself am not familiar with
17th century. So he's a modern person.
Okay.
We have an account of 251 stories about him, written by a person who was the son-in-law of Baal Shem Tov's personal scribe, his personal secretary. The accounts go back to eyewitnesses, and they are detailed accounts of him casting out demons, healing the sick, raising the dead, and doing all sorts of things. And the author tells us that these are based on eyewitness accounts, unlike the Gospels. And we know that it was written within close proximity of his life, unlike the Gospels. And yet, no one that I know of thinks that these miracles really happened.
Okay. So Bart's accusing you of double standards here, effectively, Tim. You're willing to do it for the Gospels, but not for, I can't remember the
Baal
name.
Baal Shem Tov.
Baal Shem Tov.
Right. So here's what I want to know. Were these stories circulated at the time the events were supposed to have occurred among people who fervently hated the very idea and who crucified people by the authority of the regional and omnipotent government for putting forth such stories? Or were they circulated in a community and only in a community where they would be allowed to pass because they fell in with prevailing religious expectations?
I'm sorry, you lost me. Are you saying that the stories about Jesus were being told by people who were being crucified?
In Jerusalem, where there were the Jewish rulers who had just procured the crucifixion of Jesus, a point on which I believe we are agreed.
I'm sorry. I don't understand. The Gospels weren't written in Jerusalem.
No, but the stories about Jesus were first proclaimed there. His resurrection was first proclaimed there.
Yes.
Right.
I'm sorry. I don't get what you're saying.
Are the stories about the Baal Shem Tov proclaimed in a place where he's just been crucified? Where the people who crucified him are still in power?
What?
what you're saying, Tim, here, that the context is everything. And that in the case of...
Right, it makes a difference to the credibility of a story whether we can expect that at the time and place that it's supposed to have taken place it would have been subjected to a searching examination by people who did not agree with it. For the resurrection of Jesus, we have this in spades. For the stories of the Baal Shem Tov,
I'm not talking about Baal Shem Tov wasn't raised from the dead. I'm talking about his healing the sick, raising the dead, casting
out
demons.
Right. And I'm asking you, I mean, let's.
Are you imagining that the only Christians.
Was there a powerful Muslim caliphate that would have threatened him with beatings and imprisonment and death, or his followers, if they told these stories? Or did they circulate among the Hasidim?
You have a very strange view of early Christian persecution. Where are you getting this from? Do you imagine that? Do you imagine that the early Christians were all being martyred, like the year after Jesus died?
No, I imagine that they were facing imprisonment.
Really? What's your evidence of that?
And that from that on account of their repeated assertion that Jesus had risen from the dead after being crucified by the Jewish rulers in Jerusalem, where they were speaking.
I'm not talking about Baal Shem Tov being crucified or raised from the dead.
No, I know, but what I'm pointing out is that when stories of miracles circulate only among people who would not be expected to subject them to any scrutiny, then that is prima facie a reason to doubt whether they happened. Whereas when they circulate among people who are violently inclined to disprove them, that is more interesting and puts it on the map for serious discussion. So what I'm saying is the cases are not at all analogous.
You have a very odd view of early Christian history, I have to say. If you imagine that most people who knew Jesus were being subjected to imprisonment and torture and crucifixion, I don't know where you're getting that. Most people who knew Jesus are simply telling stories about him to friends and family.
I'm talking about the people that are talked about in the book of
Acts.
This is pervasive throughout the book of Acts.
Okay, here you go. Let me tell you the situation.
I realize that you're going to try to write off the book of Acts too, but that looks to me like you're explaining away the.
Let me tell you what the book of Acts.
Tell us what the book of Acts says, but do it in about 2 minutes.
I'll do it in 2 minutes time.
Well, what I'm saying is, do it in a moment because we've got to go to a break.
I'm going
to
do it in 20 seconds. In the book of Acts, the people who tell stories about Jesus are not telling them to Jewish authorities who are looking standing on every corner, finding out if you're telling a story to Jesus, because if you tell a story of Jesus, we're going to throw you in prison. They're telling them to their friends, to their family, in private homes. And they're not telling them on the street corner where somebody's going to crack their head open and throw them in jail. So I don't know where you're getting this idea that the people telling stories about Jesus are doing so in threat of being imprisoned.
We're going to go to a break.
Maybe your Bible doesn't have Acts chapter 2 in it.
Well, look, let's come to that in a moment, and we'll come back to you immediately, Tim, as we start to close out today's program. An interesting disagreement between my two guests today as we look at whether the context, if you like, in which miraculous claims are made makes a difference to whether we can give them more credence and authority and so on. So come back in a moment's time. Justin Brierley here on Unbelievable with you. My guests, Bart Ehrman and Tim McGrew. Just at the end of this program, we're getting into the issue of the miraculous, but we've been talking about undesigned coincidences and whether they give the gospel the ring of truth. And we'll be hearing the final part of this conversation in a moment's time. Hello and welcome back to the final part of today's Unbelievable, as part of Faith Explored every Saturday afternoon, the programme that, as we say, gets Christians and non-Christians together. And I have got a real cornucopia of programmes doing just that over the summer season. We've got, obviously, this Summer of Scripture, as I've called it, where we're going to be looking at the Bible with believing and non-believing Bible scholars joining me. But we've got lots of other stuff to come as well. So the programme's brought to you in association with Premier Christianity Magazine. That's where you can find all your needs met as far as being a thinking Christian who likes to look at the issues affecting faith and the world today. PremierChristianity.com, if you want to find out more about that, follow the blog or indeed request a free sample copy of the magazine. As I say, lots of interesting programmes to come. Let me see if I can find my little rundown of the various shows that we've got going on over the summer. So next week, we'll be continuing this Summer of Scripture with Gary Habermas and James Crossley. Gary Habermas, a noted Christian thinker, philosopher, and resurrection expert, and he's debating agnostic New Testament scholar James Crossley on whether the minimal facts support the resurrection of Jesus. So if you were interested in today's programme and last week's, you'll want to come back again for that. And then later on in the following week, they're going to do a listener Q&A. I asked recently for your questions for a sort of listener question and answer session, and we got a lot of them, and they're going to be answering some of those as well. So look out for that on the Saturday, the 8th of August. And then going further forward into the summer, we're going to be hearing Zachary Arden, a young New Zealand Christian biologist, debating well-known British atheist and Oxford scientist Peter Atkins on whether science does or doesn't support belief in God. That'll be fun. Then a couple of shows with Andy Bannister. Andy was a regular person actually on the show several years ago. Then he moved out to Canada to work for RZIM there as their operations manager, and hasn't been on the show because of that so much recently. Well, he's back in the UK with a new book. It's called The Atheist Who Didn't Exist, and he's going to be with me for a couple of shows debating some of the themes from that. Firstly, whether atheism is a belief system, with atheist Ed Turner, and then whether life can have meaning without God. He's going to be debating that with atheist philosopher Michael Roos. So I promised you a series of shows with Christians and non-Christians. That's exactly what you're getting over the summer months here on Unbelievable. We'll be hearing some of your feedback to last week's programme and other recent programmes towards the end of today's show. And as ever, if you want to leave a comment about what you hear on today's programme, or find out about the other resources, the podcast, etc. for Unbelievable, then simply go to the webpage, premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable. Be interested to hear from you about today's show as well. If you want to do that, unbelievable@premier.org.uk. And of course, you can find us via Facebook at facebook.com/unbelievablejb and twitter.com/unbelievablejb to follow me on Twitter. But for the moment, let's get into the final part of today's discussion.
You're listening to Unbelievable on Premier Christian Radio.
Well, as we conclude today's discussion on undesigned coincidences and whether they give the Gospels the ring of truth, let me first of all thank both Bart and Tim, who have been my guests for the last 2 weeks now. It's been a real privilege for you both to give up your time and join me here. And I look forward to some of the responses we'll be hearing to last week's programme as well, towards the end of today's show. Just a reminder, you can send in your thoughts as well by email, unbelievable@premier.org.uk. Bart Ehrman, New Testament scholar, well known for his books questioning the reliability of the New Testament, has been debating for the last 2 weeks now Tim McGrew, who's a philosopher out at Western Michigan University, but who's turned his hand to looking into the reliability of the New Testament. We'll come back briefly towards the end of today's show to talk again about the undesigned coincidences between the Gospels that you claim, Tim. But Bart there saying, effectively, he thinks you've got a crazy idea of just how, in what context these stories of Jesus were being circulated. There wasn't sort of immediate threats of danger for people to be claiming miraculous things about Jesus. And that seems to you an important facet for why it gives them the ring of truth, if you like, because why would, you know, people hold on to, I suppose, those miraculous stories or claim them, or even the critics be talking about them if they simply had no basis in fact, I suppose. So do you want to come back on this, and we'll do a little bit more before we start to wind things up?
Sure. I'm astonished that Bart should say that they weren't out on the street corners and saying these things. The only question I have is whether it was a corner or not. But I don't see how you can read the second chapter of Acts without seeing this. I don't see how you can read the third chapter of Acts without seeing this. In Acts chapter 2, verse 14, Peter stood up with the 11, raised his voice, and addressed the crowd. That sounds like speaking on the streets, if not the corners of the streets, to me. There's a speech to the onlookers in Acts chapter 3, and the first thing you see in Acts chapter 4 is the priest and the captain of the temple guard and the Sadducees came up while they were speaking. They seized Peter and John, put them in jail until the next day. In Acts chapter 5, the high priests and the members of the party of the Sadducees are filled with jealousy. They arrested the apostles and put them in the public jail. Now, if you just want to dismiss the book of Acts as a wholesale propaganda narrative, say that.
Okay.
But
yeah,
this is all throughout the early chapters of Acts.
Okay.
Yes, it's being proclaimed. And it's being proclaimed in Jerusalem. And in fact, the secular historian Tacitus tells us in his Annals, Book 15, Chapter 44, that the mischievous superstition checked for the moment by the crucifixion of Jesus by Pilate broke out again and spread not only from Jerusalem, where it originated, but all the way to Rome. So he himself just incidentally confirms that Jerusalem was the ground zero of the proclamation of it.
Okay, let me respond to that. So you're mischaracterizing my view of Acts. Let's just assume that Acts is right. So in Acts chapter 2, Peter gets up. He gives a sermon. He has no opposition. There are 3,000 people who convert when he gives his sermon in chapter 2. In chapter 4, Peter gives another sermon. 5,000 people are joined to the church, and there's no opposition until chapter 4, when two of these people, James and John, are Peter and Peter and John are opposed. So we have 8,000 converts, and we have two people thrown in prison. Now, are we supposed to imagine that these 8,000 people who have just converted to believe in Jesus are not telling anybody about the stories they've heard? Are they not telling their spouses and their children and their slaves and their next-door neighbors? Are there Romans on every corner or Jewish authorities on every corner and in every household saying, no, you can't tell the story of Jesus to all of these 8,000 people? I think that's absolutely incredible. People are telling stories, and they're not being threatened with imprisonment. There are only two people who are imprisoned in the very story that you're talking about.
Tim?
Okay, first of all, you've got the timeline a little bit wrong. The 5,000 comes after Peter and John are arrested, and it says the number grew to about 5,000. So it's not 8,000 people before they get arrested. That occurs in that bit comes in chapter 4. Verse 4, not at the end of chapter 3, but it's continuous with the narrative in chapter 3. My point is not that people who are hearing these things are not telling what they heard. My point is that there are people proclaiming this in the face of Jewish power at the place where Jesus was crucified. And I'm sorry, but I don't believe you can find anything similar to say about the stories about the Baal Shem Tov, or for that matter, about many of the Catholic miracles in ecclesiastical history.
My point is that people are telling stories that they've heard, and it's not that they're being told under the eye of Jewish authorities. They're simply telling their family and friends. That's exactly what happened with the Baal Shem Tov.
I'm sorry. I think
you disagree.
Wildly discounting the importance of context.
Okay. We're going to have to leave it there, I'm afraid, because time really is beating us, gentlemen. But obviously, I wasn't expecting Bart to have necessarily been converted by the end of the show. I've been trying for about 8 years now to convert Bart. It hasn't quite happened yet. I get him in every year.
I convert in secret every year.
But in any case, Tim, it's been really interesting to have you on the show today to get your perspective on this. Okay, overall, Bart, though, this was a completely new thing that I said, come in, have a chat with Tim about these undesigned coincidences that he's sort of resurrected this 19th century apologetic for the credibility of the Gospels. Anything in it kind of made you think, might be interesting, could be a good, you know, there's an area to explore? Or do you really think it can all be explained by the things we've been talking about?
No, I mean, really, you know, of course, I haven't read Tim's full exposition, and so I don't know really how to deal with it in depth. But it just on hearing it at first hearing, it really does sound like 19th century apologetics to me, that that biblical scholars for a very long time have realized simply can't explain the problems of the Gospels. You can explain little coincidences here and there. It doesn't show that the Gospels as a whole are reliable. That has to be judged on other grounds. And you can't ignore these other grounds and simply pick one detail here and one detail there and say, see, they line up. I think it's a much more complicated process than that.
Okay, Tim, final thoughts from you as we close out.
Yeah, I would retort that straight back. You can't just pick one detail here and one detail there that you feel could be a contradiction or a conflict and then ignore the broad pattern of interconnection among the documents. This is not just a 19th century argument. The argument was used by F.F. Bruce. The argument is found throughout commentaries when it comes to the interconnections between the Book of Acts and the Epistles of Paul. This is one of the main reasons why we consider Romans and 1st and 2nd Corinthians and Galatians and Philippians to be unquestionably works by Paul. They interlock in so many ways with the Book of Acts. So this is not some kind of arcane argument best left on the dust heap. It's just that it hasn't been applied as vigorously to the Gospels in the 20th and 21st centuries as I think it ought to have been.
Well, it's been fascinating to get your defense of it today, Tim, and equally great to get your critique of it, Bart. And you have come completely, as it were, blind to that one. So I really appreciate you being game for doing that. And as I say, hopefully for you listening, Unbelievable is the place where you find some of the most interesting discussions between people from very different perspectives. That's what we've had today. Hope I can persuade you to come back again next year, Bart, for your, your annual grilling.
Yes, thank you.
With someone. And Tim, we've got to set something up with round two for Peter Boghossian at some point, haven't we? Because I'm sure that would generate a lot of interest as well.
It.
Yeah, that would
I'd
be
love
great.
It. Get him on.
Well, look, he's told me, I think, that he can hopefully do something towards the end of the year. He's got an app coming out, I think, to do with his atheistic sort of perspective. So we'll see what we can set up. But in the meantime, thank you both for being with me on today's programme.
Okay, thank you.
Thanks very much.
Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
It's been a really fantastic discussion, hasn't it? So why don't we go to some of the feedback that we had last week, to last week's show, where Tim and Bart met to debate the reliability of the Gospels. If you're interested in feeding back, again, unbelievable@premier.org.uk is the email address. I'd also be interested in hearing from you as well if you want to get in touch via Twitter, Facebook and all those other methods. At UnbelievableJB is the Twitter account, and several people did get back to me on last week's programme. I posted up on Twitter saying, I love getting to put people like this together. Listen to Bart Ehrman versus Tim McGrew, part one. And people like Joshua said, Justin, can you somehow convince Bart to stay in London and be on your programme every week? Use force if necessary. Not sure I can quite go that far, Joshua, but I'll make sure we try and get him in as often as possible. Mina Anthony says, I was disappointed how much the conversation was about authorship and inerrancy, not very relevant to questions of historic reliability. The atheist missionary, who's a regular on Twitter, says, my sense after carefully listening to Tim McGrew, ifs and buts were candies and nuts, every day would be Christmas. And still waiting for McGrew's extensive external evidence of gospel authorship. Well, I do know that Tim was disappointed not to be able to do more on that positive case for the authority of the gospels and so on than he was able to in that first programme. But thank you for your tweet. Peter Haraldson says, Bart seems to think that holding to some sort of inerrancy disqualifies the person to be unbiased, implicitly saying he's not. And then goes on to say there's other people, Brett Strong, who is never short of an opinion, says, wow, never seen a top Christian scholar so utterly defeated. I suggested that Brett might be slightly exaggerating, that if that was his takeaway from that discussion between Bart and Tim. And Nabil Qureshi, who was copied into that tweet, says, I haven't heard it yet. What do you think was Ehrman's strongest point? And I said, well, maybe Brett's being a little bit over-exaggeration there. And Nabil got back to me to say, yes, I think judging by some of his other tweets, I'll have to agree. And there's lots of other people weighing in on the debate as well. Bruce Nameby says, what about a Christian debate on inerrancy at some point? And here's Mike Nakadi, who said, Ehrman is one of the greats. I'd love to see him rematch William Lane Craig. Cody Cook said, I felt Tim was perhaps going out of his field. Would have loved Richard Borkham and so on. Lots of responses anyway on Twitter to that discussion. Lots of retweets as well. Thanks to those who retweeted it. Elahi, who said, a great debate on the historical reliability of the New Testament. Food for your skeptical mind. And also Coffee House Theology said, superb New Testament reliability debate between Tim McGrew and Bart Ehrman. Tactical Faith said it was a must listen. Such a thoughtful show. Thanks to all those who have been so enthusiastic about the last week's show. I hope similar responses to this week's programme. As it aired today. Now, you've been getting in touch via email again about last week's programme. And let me read at least a couple of these. Andre said, good for Tim not taking Bart's bait to paint him as an uncritical thinker. Bart's assumption is that if you believe in the inerrancy of the Bible, you cannot think critically about the Bible. In other words, only liberal scholars are real scholars, while inerrantists cannot be, therefore discrediting everything Tim has to say. On the other hand, Bart should admit that everyone, including agnostics and atheists, have a worldview perspective which influences their interpretation of the facts. This influences a person's horizon. Mike Licona explains, horizon may be defined as one's pre-understanding. It's how historians view things as a result of their knowledge, experience, beliefs, education, cultural conditioning, preferences, presuppositions, and worldview. Horizons are like sunglasses through which a historian looks. Everything she sees is coloured by the horizon. Only the naive would maintain that historians who are agnostics, atheists, or non-Christians approach the question of the historicity of the resurrection of Jesus without any bias. Here's Mike Ranieri, who says, who does Bart Ehrman think he's fooling? We all know what he's doing when he asks the inerrancy question. It's a transparent debating tactic that, quite frankly, just demonstrates his arrogance. If his opponent answers yes to holding to inerrancy, then any argumentation can be disregarded as radical fundamentalism. One might think that this presupposition can swing both ways, but not for Bart. If you come to the text as an atheist, then you are neutral and objective. Religious conviction is the only subjective and therefore deficient argument. Thinking Christians don't start with inerrancy. If someone you trusted your entire life to tells you something that's confusing or seems inconsistent, you give them the benefit of the doubt, at least until you have irrefutable information to the contrary. When one honestly studies the Bible using the historical method, one comes to realize the Bible is most often accurate and true, and any so-called small discrepancies are put on hold until more research is uncovered. Okay, so there were some of the responses via email to the edition of the show with Bart Ehrman and Tim McGrew from last week. Here's some of what came up underneath the show in the comments section, and you can do that for today's show as well. If you go to the Unbelievable website, you can get on there, you know, underneath the show that's in question and start the debate there as well. Chris Goswami said, another very listenable episode between two articulate and informed experts. Looking forward to the next one. Tim should have answered straightforwardly on the inerrancy question. The term inerrant is vague, maybe deliberately vague, but Tim could have framed it and then answered it, e.g., if we take the question on inerrancy to mean, is every word and phrase literally true? That's a different question to, is the Bible's teaching true? And even that's a different question to, do the biblical texts contain contradictions, etc.? There are many questions under this heading. Tim could have made the question specific and answered it. Overall, however, Tim came out over very convincingly at taking the wheels off the critiques thrown out by Bart. A good example was the very lengthy and arduous discussion on elapsed time between written sources and the events themselves. Bart introduced the point and then eventually agreed. It didn't prove anything either way. That seemed to be a recurring pattern. Okay, but there's criticism as well here from Jay Webb, who says, I don't mean to be disrespectful, and I'm sure Tim is a very friendly and intelligent guy in regular life, but after hearing both this and the past programme with Peter Boghossian, I think Tim McGrew has got to be one of the slipperiest conversationists I've ever heard. You just cannot get this man to talk straight. Every point you make or question you pose to him merits three dodges, one change of subject, and two quibbles about the definitions of words. I'm imagining a play for the stage. Tim, did you take the trash out? Okay, first of all, I object to your outdated, unscholarly definition of trash because you know very well that many scholars now define trash in a way that means 3 minutes later. And sixth, just because you see the trash still inside the house doesn't mean many other chores haven't been done already without your knowledge. And finally, Dr. Brackish Oaken of the University of Nevada points out that garbage is actually a more serious problem for the trash removers rather than trash producers. So I reject your underlying assumption that garbage day is the only day of the week that matters. That said, he's a smart guy and I appreciate his energy, so I hope he and his supporters take this critique in good fun. Please, sir, a little more straight talk would help your case a lot. Well, Paul Brennan got in on that and said to Jay Webb in response, a little more straight talk. What exactly do you want? What exactly did Tim McGrew say that wasn't straight talk? And what straight talk does your post provide? To which Jay Webb responds, by straight talk, I mean just clearly and simply saying what you think rather than jumping around, dodging certain topics and trying to confuse the subject of conversation. For starters, directly answering Bart's question about his position on inerrancy would have helped a lot. Another example is the way he would move the goalposts and change the subject in the middle of an exchange. To which Paul replies, oh, so you think Tim should have ignored the context of the discussion and wasted everyone's time discussing something that can neither be proved nor disproved. Brilliant. Listen, Mr. J. Webb, no one, and I mean no one, can with certainty claim that the Bible is inerrant, firstly, and gasp as much as you want about this, the word demands a definition that all parties can accept. Secondly, you would need to be God himself in order to know such a thing, and yet you and all the other Bart Ehrman cheerleaders here demand something that no one can honestly answer, and would most likely be a total waste of everyone's time in a debate like this. So it goes on, and others get in on the act too. Interesting stuff. So again, if you want to read those comments underneath last week's programme, it's there at premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable. So thanks for all who have encouraged and said they really enjoyed that show. It's great to have so many people who obviously enjoyed the programme of last week. Let's go to some other thoughts, though, to other shows that have come and gone in the last few weeks. I'm just leafing through my correspondence here to try and find some of the ones. Here's one again. This is Andre again, who wants to pick up on that show between Nabil Qureshi and Andrew White, debating the diversity of Christian belief. And he says, I was surprised by Nabil's response to the often contradictory views that Christians hold. He said, God loves diversity, God loves latitude, that's why we have Greg Boyd from open theist all the way to hyper-Calvinist. I'd agree that God loves diversity when it comes to gifts of the Holy Spirit for the building up of the body of Christ. However, I don't think this applies to important doctrines, such as the nature of his attributes, open theism, and how he should be worshipped, strange fire and charismatics and so on. It is this type of doctrinal diversity that has divided Christians into the often quoted 30,000 denominations since the Reformation. I think Nabil misses the Andrew's point. The diversity in Christian doctrine should not be compared to the diversity in political beliefs in the secular world. Jesus sent the Holy Spirit to indwell every believer, to guide them in all truth, so that we might understand the things freely given us by God. Jesus prayed Christians would be one, perfected in unity. God equipped his church so that we would attain unity of the faith. If all these Christians are indwelt by the Holy Spirit, are sincerely seeking the truth and praying for God's guidance, I can see why the doctrinal diversity and division of the church could be a stumbling block to faith. Kenneth goes further back still and wants to talk about that transgender episode and says, just listen to another fascinating show. Wow. It's rare to have such a balanced debate on really sensitive matters like this. And just to remind you, if you aren't familiar with that episode, it was two Christians, one a transgender Christian and one who was a former transgender. They reversed their operation and debating the rights and wrongs of whether people should have those kinds of operations and so on. Well, Kenneth says, I must say I find it chilling and unnerving to lead children down the trans path because they wear dresses and play with dolls. And yet on something less important like voting or drinking, we tell them they're too young. Really? And if you don't win an award this season, there's simply no justice or the panellists are oblivious to quality. Thank you, Kenneth. Very kind. I'll make sure any judging panellists know your thoughts on that. It's been fun anyway. Thank you for some of the various emails and tweets and comments that we've had on the website over the last week or so. We'll be bringing you more of those next week as we continue our summer of scripture. So do hope you can come back for what promises to be another really interesting and top level scholarly debate on whether the historical facts support the resurrection.
You're unbelievable.
We're going to be talking about what has sometimes been called the minimal facts approach to the resurrection. And one of the people who's really worked on that and is a bit of an expert on it is Gary Habermas. He joins me in studio next week, along with agnostic New Testament scholar James Crossley. So they'll be debating this question of whether, if you look at the minimal historical facts that the majority of Bible scholars believe whether they're believers or not, then you get a case for the resurrection. Is the resurrection the best explanation then of these minimal facts? It's going to take us down the route of asking questions about whether historians can come to, if you like, theological conclusions. And we're going to be having a really interesting time on that next week. So I hope you can come back for that. James Crossley and Gary Habermas on the programme next week. For the moment, thank you for listening to Unbelievable, your weekly dose of apologetics debate and theological conundrums. And I hope you can come back again for the same thing next week. For the moment, coming up next, it's The Profile. Erica Freemantle is the guest, and I'll see you same time next week.